Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. It was a very busy news week for police departments and communities affected by police violence and police scandals across the country. Yesterday, a judge cleared Baltimore police officer Caesar Goodson Jr. of all charges in the death of 25-year-old Freddie Gray. Goodson drove the van in which Freddie Gray was fatally injured. Prosecutors said Goodson deliberately threw Gray, who was shackled, into the back of the van and gave him a, quote, rough ride. They also said he failed to secure Freddie Gray in a seatbelt and had five chances to provide aid to Gray after his neck was broken in the back of the van. But after an eight-day trial, Judge Barry Williams said the state lacked evidence. Also yesterday, a Texas grand jury decided not to indict McKinney police officer Eric Casebolt for manhandling a black 15-year-old girl at a pool party last June. You probably saw that video. Kim Cole, the attorney representing the girl's family, said, quote, "We are currently in a day and time where the very people who are sworn to enforce the law are not held to uphold the law, and that has got to change," end quote. Here in the Bay Area, families of unarmed people of color who've been killed by San Francisco police officers are still seeking answers and justice. The department is also still dealing with a racist text scandal. And the Oakland Police Department is reeling from a sex scandal, also a racist text scandal. The Oakland PD has had three chiefs in 8 days. The East Bay Express broke the story. It's called Badge of Dishonor. Top Oakland Police Department officials looked away as East Bay cops sexually exploited and trafficked a teenager. Based on the information shared through this story, it appears that this young woman was the victim of trafficking. Today, we are talking about how the media cover police departments, police misconduct, and police scandals. Joining us today are three reporters. Jonah Lamb is a criminal justice reporter with the San Francisco Examiner, and he's been closely following what's happening here in San Francisco and in Oakland. And Jonah joins me in studio. Hi, Jonah. Welcome back to the show.
How you doing?
Great to have you. We're also joined by Julia Craven. She is a politics reporter with the Huffington Post, and she joins us from Washington, D.C. Hi, Julia. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. And Lawrence Lanahan is a freelance print and radio journalist. His year-long investigation of regional inequality in Baltimore, called The Lines Between Us, won the 2014 Alfred DuPont Columbia University Award. And Lawrence has been covering the community in which Freddie Gray lived. And he joins us from Baltimore's NPR station, WYPR. Hi, Lawrence. Welcome back.
Hey, Rose. Thanks for having me back.
It's great to have you. So as we always do on Your Calls Media Roundtable, we start off on a positive note and highlight journalism that stood out this week. So, Jonah, let's start off with you. What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, I'd start with the Mother Jones piece by Shane Bauer. He was a kidnapped victim of the Iranian regime. But anyway, he's back here. He wrote a story about 4 months he spent working in a private prison in Louisiana. I thought it was kind of great in the tradition of Jacob Riis and Nellie Bly and all the old kind of, you know, go in undercover kind of journalism and expose kind of the underbelly of institutions. So it was really good. It was well told and I enjoyed it.
It's on my to-do list. I just read the first two sentences about how he was shocked that this prison company didn't do more background research on him. I mean, he was really honest about his resume, and they gave him the job.
I mean, this is true. There's a book called New Jack, published in 2000 by Ted Conover. He worked in Sing Sing, and the same was true. He got a job for an actual, like, state-run prison, and he didn't lie about who he was, and they still let him spend a year there.
Right. And so he was completely honest. Maybe they did background, maybe they didn't care, but he got the job. Just quickly, what did you take away from that lengthy piece?
I took away more that there is essentially seems to be no oversight for this big chunk of the prison system run in these by these private firms, and it's pretty scary. I mean, just the first page you're reading about how they're saying you can beat prisoners and none of the kind of oversight or protections that you would expect, or at least hope for, by people who are running prisons.
All right, so kudos to Shane Bauer, who wrote this piece for Mother Jones, My 4 Months as a Private Prison Guard. And we will have Shane on in the future to talk about that. We should also do a show about journalists who cover traumatic war-like situations, because Shane has sure been through
a lot. No kidding.
All right, so thank you for that. That's Jonah Lamb. He's a criminal justice reporter with the San Francisco Examiner. What about you, Julia? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Outside, it's really hard to follow up that Mother Jones piece, honestly. But there was this little thing in The Atlantic called Why Schools Need More Principals of Color. It was by Melinda Anderson. And it was really short, but it was very to the point about the benefits of having black principals. And I just thought it was good, especially since we're in this moment where we're talking about the school-to-prison pipeline and, you know, things like that.
Is it safe to assume that a very large percentage of principals across the country are not people of color?
Yes.
All right. Well, that also sounds really interesting, because I have some teacher friends who talk about this a lot. So kudos to Melinda Anderson with The Atlantic, Why Schools Need More Principals of Color. And that is Julia Craven. She's a politics reporter with The Huffington Post. And what about you, Lawrence? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, of course, Shane's piece. I mean, I'm not even all the way through it. It's just amazing. The prison system is such a black box, and all of a sudden you're seeing everything. It's shocking. Mm. And I'm a fan of Melinda Anderson, so I'm glad that got a shout-out. I guess I'll go with Lawrence Jackson's piece about the Freddie Gray trial in Harper's. He grew up in Baltimore, and this first part of this, it's a long story, but he's in the courtroom, and it ends up he kind of recognizes a couple of the bailiffs. It just shows you what a small world West Baltimore can be. Hmm. And he writes, everybody's written about this trial. It's tough to kind of to break through. But because of his background, this thing is just really, really compelling. He ends up telling his family's story in this way that kind of walks you through the history of structural racism in our region, all the way back from, you know, the kind of redlining policies and all that. So you get the important historical context about why there are places about West Baltimore, but with amazing, very personal detail about what it's like to live there.
So kudos to Lawrence Jackson, a writer for Harper's, who actually lives in Baltimore.
Well, he doesn't anymore.
But he doesn't anymore.
But he did long enough to be able to pull this off real well.
Okay, well, that's good, because I wanted to talk to you about this, about, you know, so many journalists across the country, and maybe probably even international journalists, went to Baltimore when this happened because it got international attention. So you've got journalists that don't really have the context, and then you have journalists like Lawrence and like yourself who do have the context to go beyond the reporting about the day-to-day in the courtroom and bring in community voices and talk about the history of racism, poverty, neglect by the state in that area. Can you talk a little bit about that, just the importance of bringing that context to this story?
Sure. I mean, you have to understand why there are these places. It's almost a quarantine in West Baltimore, where these decades of policies have created these almost entirely black, very poor areas. And it's a lot easier. It's a lot, there's a lot more incentive to police roughly in these places, because the rest of the region wants that kind of place contained. You know, I think the state's attorney had already said, you know, before Freddie Gray's arrest, hey, this is a high crime area. This is a real priority. You guys need to go in there and police real hard. So the story, as much as it is about the tragedy of what happened to Freddie Gray, needs to also be about, is there going to be another one, and why?
Hmm.
And why these places don't change. And I think people can get glued to the images of the burning CVS, or get outraged by what, you know, a handful of police officers may have done to one person. But it's important to know why these things keep happening, and that part of those reasons were policy, involved our tax dollars. So you have to do this sort of contextual investigative journalism so we can understand how things got to be the way they are.
I think that it's really interesting to kind of think about that in the context of San Francisco, especially the Alex Nieto case. He was a gentleman shot and killed by police in a park, and there was kind of a lot of back and forth when Rebecca Solnit, a local journalist, wrote a piece about it and kind of tried to tell the story of this police violence kind of side by side with gentrification. And, you know, I thought it was a good piece, but I thought kind of when you're speaking about these larger policies and how they kind of direct and kind of make police act a certain way, it's kind of this invisible force. And I think that a lot of the times people don't think about that in San Francisco, specifically when they talk about police violence and police action. They think maybe there's one bad cop doing something. Where that can be the case, I think what's missed is that kind of police forces, the nature of police as a security force, and the way the state kind of puts them in place, that's kind of more important, I think, in terms of why they act the way they do. Not always there's, you know, a white cop in a black neighborhood, because you can have cops doing things that cops have kind of been doing for a long time in all sorts of contexts.
Can you?
Yeah, you got to put police. Oh, I'm sorry.
Go ahead, John, Lawrence.
It's Lawrence. Yeah, I think it's important to connect policing to property values, and it's a lot more bonkers out there where you guys are than it is here. But you know, one of the things I've written about here is in Sandtown, there's a multiracial church that encourages anyone who wants to quote unquote help the neighborhood to actually live there. So you have white people moving in. And part of what this church does is sort of walk you through, like, hey, you can't just, you know, share a Coke and have interpersonal racial harmony. Everything's going to be okay. They talk to white people about what it's like to live in a neighborhood like this. And one of the things they say is, all right, would you call 911 for this? Would you call 911 for this? And you realize that communities have ways of solving problems where you don't have to go right to the police.
I mean, I think there's a... Sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead.
There's a book, Ghetto Side. It was by an LA Times reporter. I think she kind of pointed out a really interesting fact about how kind of policing acts in these communities that are kind of either over-policed, by either police kind of come in there and do a rough job, or under-policed, and then they don't really solve the problems that are like serious crimes, murders. So essentially what you have is kind of system of justice that's created by the people who live there. I mean, this might speak to what you're saying in that you live in a community that the police are either beating you up or not solving the real crimes, you're going to kind of find ways to deal with situations differently than, say, someone who's used to the police and the state doing the job that they're supposed to do. But I think coming back to San Francisco, and part of the kind of issue I had with this argument about, say, gentrification being a force to make police do things, I think that ignores the fact that police or shooting and killing people before gentrification was coming along. I mean, you could argue that gentrification has always been a force in San Francisco, but I don't know. 1992 San Francisco was a much rougher place, and cops are still shooting people, and I don't think you can necessarily draw a line between, like, you know, where the rich people live and where the poor people live, and the cops are, like, you know, standing in a line to prevent that from happening. Obviously, they're doing that, yes, but I have police shooting statistics back to 1996, and they're doing plenty of shooting all over the place. Mm. So anyway,
the videos and the social media have raised so much awareness about what's actually happening on the streets. Julia, why don't you jump in here? I mean, Jonah and Lawrence are bringing up some big topics related to police violence and what happens in communities. What are your thoughts on reporting and providing the context about these different places and what these communities have to endure?
Well, I think context is very important, obviously. I assume that we all do because we're all, you know, journalists. But one thing that really struck me, or this one thing that kept going through my mind whenever y'all were discussing this, is that these issues are becoming prevalent and well-known to white people. Mm-hmm. Like, black people have always known that the police system is against us. We've always known that this is something that disproportionately affects us, whereas now, because of social media, because you have more national news outlets picking it up, because of Ferguson, because of what happened in Baltimore last year, and the citizens taking it, like, taking their frustrations to the streets and being like, we're not going to take this anymore. You can't continue to come into our neighborhoods and do this to us. Now we're having these big national conversations about it. And that is, all of that is one reason why I think context is so important, because it's vital that this issue not be painted as though it's, you know, here. It's new. It's just happening.
Yeah, and that's something I struggle with as a white journalist covering black communities, is a lot of the people who are going to read my thing are going to say, thanks, yeah, not news.
I mean, it's part of the other problem, too, I think, is that...
I struggle with that, too, so don't feel bad.
Or after 2 years of doing this, you know, they maybe get sick of it. There's that worry that people are going to continually be, you know, not wanting to hear about police misdeeds. But the other side is, you know, you can cover this kind of day in and day out, and I work at a daily newspaper, so we have to print a story every day, and a lot of times we can't really get the context, the larger kind of socioeconomic context, into these stories about police violence or police racism or, you know, just policing in general. So sometimes I wish in our context we could do that more. That's just a kind of a factor of the way we have to produce the news.
And what about the community response? Because, Julia, back in January, you wrote a piece for the Huffington Post called Baltimore Residents Never Expected a Cop to Be Punished for Killing Freddie Gray. Black Americans just don't have a lot of faith in the justice system, and history is on their side. Honestly, when I read that story, I thought you wrote it a couple days ago, but you wrote it back in January.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those stories where it's pretty evergreen, sadly.
Right.
If you know the history, if you understand that modern day policing and these institutions grew out of slave patrols, and it's kind of hard to articulate it, but it's like, if you look at history, if you look at how police have always treated non-white people, if you look at the civil rights movement and the police response to that, it makes sense as to why black people are just like, oh, well, I mean, yeah, of course they're not going to be convicted, on top of the fact that it's just really hard to get a cop convicted anyway.
Yeah.
It's pretty much impossible to do that. We've seen an uptick in those cases. I think it's because of Black Lives Matter. I think it's because of protests in Baltimore and in Ferguson. But even with Rodney King back in 92, I mean, I don't really think a lot of people expected those cops to be convicted, especially when they moved the trial to Simi Valley.
I mean, in San Francisco alone, this is only in police shooting cases, but I don't think the DA's ever charged any cop ever, let alone in other cases. I mean, most of the time, the only cases where you have kind of police corruption that actually are charged, it's the feds that come in and do those cases, and those are kind of few and far between.
Right.
Yeah, here in Baltimore, there was, as long as we're talking about the media, there's a really good four-part series where the Baltimore police allowed a Baltimore Sun reporter to embed with the detectives who are doing the investigation to give the information to the prosecutor, Marilyn Mosby, about what happened to Freddie Gray. And it's fascinating, but the story that wasn't there, that probably couldn't happen, is, you know, hanging out in the prosecutor's office for the 2 weeks while they did their investigation, because the prosecution did a separate investigation. And I don't know if you remember, but they announced those charges right quick.
Hmm. I think this speaks.
Took the police department by surprise. No, they took the police department by surprise, and it shows you the tensions of having the prosecutors who are every day working with police to prosecute, alleged criminals in these neighborhoods. Suddenly, the prosecution's investigating the police, and we expect it to go smoothly.
There's been those same tensions in San Francisco. The DA has kind of come out strong as a reformer and says he's going to go after cops. And then you have these other efforts to, say, create an independent Bureau of Investigation in the DA's office that will investigate police misconduct. But the people always kind of ask, well, these are still prosecutors. These are still kind of like law and order-minded folk. And they wonder, like, are they really going to do the job that we would want them to do?
Jonah,
they're elected, too.
Yeah.
Jonah Lamb is a criminal justice reporter with the San Francisco Examiner. Julia Craven is a politics reporter with the Huffington Post. And Lawrence Lanahan is a freelance print and radio journalist. And today, it's our media roundtable. We are talking about how reporters cover police departments, police misconduct, police scandals. What are your thoughts? So much is happening this week with police departments across the country. What have you been following? What are your thoughts on how reporters should cover these issues, 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. You can also tweet us at Your Call Radio. And I wanted to ask you, Julia, because the Freddie Gray decision came down yesterday, the case in Texas didn't get as much attention, and you wrote about that. It got a lot of attention when it happened. So we just learned that a Texas grand jury decided not to indict McKinney police officer Eric Casebolt for manhandling a black 15-year-old girl at a pool party last June. How did you decide? I mean, you wrote a quick story to get the word out, but then you expanded your story. How did you decide what angle to take on that?
I mean, the angle was, it was pretty simple for me. Like, you get your stub up so that, you know, you can get the news out there, and hopefully you're first. I was not first, but that's fine. That's not the point. And then you start going back in and you start adding the context. So I hit up Kim Cole, the attorney representing Becton's family, because I wanted to know how she felt about it. I wanted to know how her clients felt about it, because this is something that affects them. We're spectators. We're watching this happen. We have our opinions about cops and how they should conduct themselves in certain situations. But ultimately, at the center of this case is a 15-year-old girl who was brutalized just because she has, like, she was talking back like any 15-year-old girl is going to do. So it's important to reach out to them and see how they feel about this. Mm.
What about that, Lawrence, reaching out to the attorneys, the family, giving them a voice in this?
Well, sure. I mean, you want to hear that. But in the Freddie Gray case, you know, essential context is that, I forget the exact timing, but the city did a $6 million settlement with the family.
Right.
And that colors what you're going to hear from them. It is important to at least reach out to them. It's hard to get around their lawyers. You know what I mean? What you get is a statement with the lawyer, and from a lawyer that's probably been in the paper every day for the last 20 years, and it's kind of like puts this veil over it.
Here we have the usual suspect lawyers who kind of almost always represent those families. Here it's John Burris, but John Burris actually is really open, really media savvy, and the families are always there to talk, and he's always bringing them along. So I think, at least in the coverage of these cases in San Francisco Bay Area, there's always been the family voices. I think the other side of the difficulty, this is kind of more broadly speaking in terms of covering criminal justice, is it's kind of, in lots of ways, a locked box by the nature of the work they do. So I think, unlike other reporting, you know, you can't sunshine everything. You can't FOIA everything. So a lot of the work that I do and the stuff that I'm most proud of is, you know, you have to develop sources in the department. And so you have to kind of check sources against each other. And that's when you really get the stuff that isn't going to come out otherwise. Because, you know, you can go to court and, you know, I love covering court cases, and there's always really good stuff in documents in courts. But there's this other side of it, kind of the internal workings of these law enforcement agencies that you're not going to get unless you know people in those agencies that are going to talk to you.
How difficult is it to get sources inside police departments?
I think it just takes time. And, you know, if you kind of usually they'll reach out to you sometimes. If you do a story that they see, that kind of prompts them then to speak to you again. And I talk to every single cop I see everywhere. I give them my card. Usually they just probably throw it away. But I try to just like make my face known, and I make it so they know who I am.
Well, after the break,
and
I want
to talk.
Lawrence, we're going to go to a quick break. After the break, I just want to talk to all of you about what it is like to cover the police department. And then also, what should the media call these scandals? Is it a sex scandal? Is it a rape scandal? Because some of these officers had sex with this girl when she was 17, and then she turned 18. So we actually have an email about that. Today we're joined by Jonah Lamb, criminal justice reporter with the San Francisco Examiner, Julia Craven, politics reporter for the Huffington Post. Lawrence Lanahan is a freelance print and radio journalist. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KALW, local public radio. If you have a perspective you haven't heard in today's discussion or a question that you feel needs to be answered, please join the conversation by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK, toll-free. You can also send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org or post a comment or question at the show's website, yourcallradio.org.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up next week, we are going to do a week-long series on the homeless crisis in San Francisco. You may have heard that on June 29th, more than 70 Bay Area media outlets will come together for a day of coverage. We are going to do a week of coverage. On Monday, we will be live from St. Anthony's in the Tenderloin. Advocates sit there say that demand for services is on the rise. Tuesday, we will be live at Larkin Street Youth Services in the Tenderloin. Wednesday, we'll speak with advocates about how we got here, solutions, major, major budget cuts to HUD back in the 70s. A lot of advocates say that's why we have this problem. And then on Thursday, we will open the lines and take your questions for Jeff Kositsky. He is head of San Francisco's new Department of Homelessness. So I hope you can join us for this week-long series next week. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.com. Today, it's our media roundtable. We are speaking with reporters about how they cover police forces, police scandals, and police misconduct. We're joined today by Jonah Lamb, criminal justice reporter with the San Francisco Examiner, Julia Craven, politics reporter with the Huffington Post, and Lawrence Lanahan, a freelance print and radio journalist. If you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. I want to dive in and talk about this scandal that's happening with the Oakland Police Department. It's a huge scandal. The East Bay Express broke it. And first, I want to ask all three of you, just what are your thoughts about how when someone of color is killed or people of color are killed, there are many layers to the story. Reporters have to get many different sides. But what I found really interesting when I learned about this sex scandal or rape scandal, whatever you call it, and we'll talk about that in a minute, it was almost like, boom, this happened. These cops are gone. We're going to get new chiefs in there. And Libby Schaff talked to the reporters. I mean, it happened so fast, right, with a sex scandal.
Yeah.
Whereas when people of color are killed, there are many complexities, and you've got to get many different sides of this. Jonah, can you talk about that?
I mean, I have only been observing it from this side of the Bay.
Right.
I think it's just so cut and dry in terms of wrongdoing. She was underage when this occurred. There was... obviously, police are not supposed to be having sexual relationship with prostitutes anyway, prostitute, sex worker, whatever, you know, you verbiage you're going to use. So I think it was pretty obvious kind of how widespread and wrong it was what was happening. What happens when you have other instances like, say, shootings, it's kind of in a cloak. It's hidden. It might not have happened. You might not have seen it. Like, it might happen at night, and then the police are investigating it. So it's a lot harder to kind of get at what's going on. And I think the reporters over at East Bay Express have really good sourcing, obviously, but also I think that there's been a lot that's come to the surface, and just the obviousness of the wrong. And the mayor has acted with the swiftness that I am just shocked at every day, because she's, you know, three police chiefs in a week. It's moving pretty fast, and I think you want to do that as a mayor politically, even, because you're moving this through. You're not going to take it. In San Francisco, other scandals have been like slow, roiling scandals that have had to finally kind of surface. And I think it just speaks to maybe her political savviness. I don't know.
Well, and so just to give a bit of background again, the East Bay Express broke this story. You can read it. Badge of dishonor. Top Oakland Police Department officials looked away as East Bay cops sexually exploited and trafficked a teenager. This girl is Celeste Guap. She is speaking with the media. She says she had sex with a dozen Oakland police officers. She is currently 18, but she said she did have sex with some police officers when she was 17, which puts her underage. Jonah, you've read extensively about this. What else can you tell us, just for people who haven't been following this closely?
So it occurred, kind of the circumstances, 2015, she's working on International Avenue in East Oakland, where there's a lot of open prostitution. She's running away from a pimp at
right.
the time.
So she was trafficked.
Yeah.
Right.
So she was trafficked, and OPD officer, a guy who actually went to high school in San Francisco, Officer O'Brien, Brendan O'Brien, he kind of saves her, so to speak. And she said this. She's so spoken to the media and said that she thought that he saved her. That relationship develops into a sexual relationship. Then that expands to sexual relationships with other officers who then are not only kind of protecting her, that's the way she saw it, they were kind of giving her aid, but also telling her about stings that were coming down. And then that expanded to officers at Richmond PD. She's alleged the Alameda County Sheriff's Department. She's also alleged that three San Francisco PD officers are involved. She made contact with a deputy chief on Facebook, and the deputy chief is now under investigation. And there's two other officers whose names have not yet come to light. So it's kind of like slowly expanding across the Bay Area, these links between all these officers and what was done in the circumstance.
Do you know where this girl is now? She's been doing some TV interviews. I wonder if she's getting help.
I don't know. I've tried to contact her myself for stories I've done in the SFPD here. It's really hard to know where she is. I think she lives in the East Bay. That's about all I know. You know, I've talked to reporters who had contact with her, and I've tried to get them to put me in contact. And I think at this point, you know, she's talking to TV. She's talking to lots of different media, so I think it's really hard to know.
Mm. Lawrence, what are your thoughts on this and just the swift action that was taken after this story broke versus the other stories that we have been talking about for, you know, the last couple of years now?
Yeah, it's got my head spinning just trying to keep up with it.
Yeah, it's hard to keep up with it.
I can't think of a story here. I mean, we have one of the, I think one of the former Oakland police commissioners or had here, Anthony Batts, and it was quite a while after some controversy before he left. You know, things developed a lot more slowly here on that one, but three chiefs in a week. I can't get my head around that.
Julia, what are your thoughts?
That's a busy news week. I don't think it. God, that never happens. It just never goes down that fast. Usually, like you were saying with Baltimore, and also in Chicago. How, like, the Laquan McDonald scandal happened, and even getting Gary out of there, that happened really fast. So three in a week, I can't wrap my mind around that either.
It could speak a little to the kind of political weight that the chiefs hold. Like, since San Francisco, Chief Sir, who resigned, I mean, a month ago, so we had that, he had a real political kind of power base in San Francisco, and I think that that really helped him keep his position, whereas, you know, the Ghent or the first police chief to go down, I don't know what kind of political kind of role he played in that city. He was kind of placed in that position inadvertently as well, so I don't think he had the same kind of power. And I'm sure in these other cities, Chicago, Baltimore, you know, police chiefs kind of are political players like anybody else, and it's harder to get them out if they have a power base.
Jonah Lamb is a criminal justice reporter with the San Francisco Examiner. Julia Craven is a politics reporter with the Huffington Post. And Lawrence Lanahan is a freelance print and radio journalist. Lawrence is in Baltimore and Julia is in Washington, D.C. And we're talking today about how the media cover police forces, the power of police forces, scandals, and misconduct. You can join us at 866-798-8255. Also, the language. What language should we use here? Scandal, rape scandal, sex scandal. 866-798-8255. You can tweet us at Your Call Radio or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Let's hear from Samantha in San Francisco. Hi, Samantha. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you for your show. I just wanted to comment real quick. I'm really happy that you guys mentioned John Burris's firm. I think it's great representation. I've noticed that they've greatly expanded to like 7 lawyers in the last 5 years. I reached out to them when I was raped, and it was handled poorly by some cops here in the city.
Mm.
Also, I just wanted to mention Ella Baker Center is a great resource. They had a Justice Rising event that discussed the school-to-prison pipeline, and had some really fabulous speakers, one of which was Shaka, and one of which was Michelle Alexander. So I'm really just happy to say that there are some voices here. I was wondering, if you are a freelance writer and you are interested in investigating specifically police corruption, how would one go about doing that? And then secondly, I would say maybe this is a sex scandal, being that I was raped. Like, this woman from some of the text seemed, you know, to somewhat be working within that context of sex work, maybe. Though she's underage, and maybe she has had a difficult experience with the pimp. There was an engagement there. There was some manipulation. It's a sex scandal, but it's certainly corruption. And I also wanted to say, we take in mind, too, the Stanford prison experiment, when we know that sometimes absolute power can corrupt absolutely. Like, there has to be a teaching of ethics with regard to police authority.
Well, thank you, Samantha. Thanks for sharing your story. What about that? Lawrence, you're a freelance print and radio journalist, although you've worked for the NPR affiliate in Baltimore. How do you go about creating these relationships, finding sources, and exposing corruption?
Well, it's harder as a freelancer because you don't have an organization behind you.
Right.
It takes real organizational resources. I would want a team. I would want a mentor, you know what I mean? So that kind of just going straight at a police department with a strictly investigative story is harder for me to do. And frankly, I don't do that kind of thing as much because I know that, like, the team at the Sun or the Baltimore Brew or someplace around here is going to do it better. I do try to cultivate sources in the police department. But it's, you know, what are you trying to get out of that? It's hard to do any kind of pulse taking because, I don't know, you talk to a lower level, you know, somebody just on the beat, that's a little easier if they'll actually talk to you, to just kind of BS them on the street, and you'll hear this, you'll hear that. Talk to a mid-level detective, they'll tell you another thing, but is that what's really going on? Is that the consensus? So I have a few police sources just to keep my, just have some sense of what's going on. But as a freelancer, you really need to partner with an organization, I think, to do an effective and economical investigation.
I'm a beat reporter, so I'm essentially just like a cops and courts reporter. I mean, I like to think I do more than that. But so for me, and I'm at a daily newspaper, so I'm there every day. You know, I'm at every police commission. I am at every shooting. I'm at every police shooting. I'm at every big trial. So that is surprisingly, I didn't think before I was a beat reporter it would be so lucrative. But, you know, you get to know the faces. You get to know the cops. And you meet the guy who works in IA because you're at the court.
IA?
Internal Affairs.
Okay.
So you meet the internal affairs inspector, and then you see him later on, or you'll see him at the mall or something. There's not many malls here, but you'll see him somewhere. So you have these kind of relationships, and after a period of time, names will pop up. You know, you'll have people in all these circumstances that are sources that you develop over time. And I think, at least for me, that's how I do it.
Anything to add on that, Julia?
No. Not really. They pretty much said everything.
All right. Well, thank you for that phone call, Samantha. Let's go next to KDF in Oakland. Hi, KDF. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Rose. Two things. One is, gender makes a difference. Mayor Schaaf stated she's not willing to have a frat house for a police department, but she's finding frats everywhere in the police department. That's why she keeps firing these guys, is because they're frat boys. And a question I have about the sex scandal is, why do your guests think no language of statutory rape has ever been used in print or the media about all these sex scandal cops? And also, you know, this is sex under the color of authority. Nobody's talking about that.
Well, thank you. We have a related email from Matthew, who says the evidence is overwhelming of widespread instances of statutory rape occurring through the police departments of the East Bay. Why is there zero discussion in media outlets about criminal prosecution? The timing of these revelations occurring in the wake of the shocking verdict in the recent Stanford rape case is striking. Is there media silence about criminal prosecutions for rapes against East Bay officers? What are your thoughts,
Jonah? I think the East Bay Express has mentioned statutory rape in their reporting. Our reporting has just been further kind of not touching as much on it, and we're reporting kind of in terms of what the PD here and what relation they have. Some of these cases might have happened when she was 18 years old, not 17. A lot of these cases, it's unclear maybe when it happened. I mean, I think there are some distinct cases where she had sex with officers in the East Bay when she was 17, which is statutory rape. And the East Bay Express has printed that.
Also, the East Bay Express reports that according to several legal experts, any police officer who had sex with Celeste Guap before she was 18 is guilty of human trafficking.
And the East Bay Alameda County Sheriff's Department has cleared their two deputies who were alleged to have sex with her. And they essentially said they had sex with her when she was 18, and therefore there's nothing that was done that was wrong.
And Dr. Alexandra Letnick is a research scientist with RTI International. She says the case shows how social control agents, including cops, can abuse their power, especially in environments where sex work is criminalized and law enforcement agencies emphasize cracking down on the activity. For more than a decade, Oakland's cops have prioritized going after the city's sex industry and have framed their enforcement efforts as an attack against human trafficking and the exploitation of children. And this is according to the East Bay Express article. Thanks for calling in, KDF. Let's hear next from Arthur in San Francisco. Hi, Arthur. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I'd like to reinforce what was said earlier in the program about gentrification being a force behind much of the police pressure being put on people on the street. And force is really personified by Edwin Lee, who seems to have maybe at the center of his being some deep felt shame about confronting people who are poverty stricken, something unknown in his own background. I'd like to just also point out that there was an extraordinary picture in the Chronicle at the height of the demonstrations, self-starvation of the five people at Mission Station, and in it, Edwin Lee turned up with Joe Marshall, a member in good standing of the police commission, and he, along with some other mayor's office aide, allowed themselves to be photographed, their own photographer, and they showed an empty chair, and they had showed up unannounced at Mission Station, and said that the gist of it was that the people at Mission Station demonstrating were unwilling to negotiate with the mayor. And in fact, had been completely unannounced and unwanted and had not been in accord with what they had previously discussed. But Joe Marshall was there smiling into the camera. So how reliable how much faith could you put in a police commission that may consist of one or more Joe Marshalls in negotiating, so-called negotiations, with the police department and with other agencies to develop a new code.
Let me jump in here. I mean, the police commission is appointed by the mayor. The rest are appointed by the Board of Supervisors. So they are mayoral appointees. But I really do think that, you know, the pressure that's been put on this administration, Ed Lee's administration, since the Mario Woods killing in December, there's been action. Whether or not you think it's perfect, I mean, an administration that wasn't doing much is all of a sudden doing lots of things. The DOJ is reviewing, the police department, the commission just passed a new use of force policy, which went against a lot of the recommendations by the police union. They have body cameras coming down the line. I mean, you know, to me, I've been watching the police commission for the last 2 years, going to every meeting, and actually the last one I went to, I wasn't the only one. People in the audience were saying, this is kind of how the process is supposed to work. I beat up on the police department a lot in my coverage, and so I think when I see something working to some degree, I'm going to point it out. I mean, still, that doesn't mean it's going to happen. That doesn't mean that there aren't issues with discipline and oversight that I don't think are going to change with a new chief. We know we have a new chief here. I just wrote a story today about how, you know, we had this text scandal about 2 years ago where all these officers were caught sending racist text messages.
In San Francisco.
There's about 14 of them. The chief moved quickly to fire 8 of them. What happened is they went to court and the judge ruled that the department had waited too long to discipline them and the statute of limitations had run out. So they're now in the appeals court. But I went and did a search to see how many other cases the department had let that statute of limitation run out. or during Sir's administration, and there were 16 other cases. So this is an example of the department not following through on disciplines, whether or not they're really serious disciplines or not. If you're not disciplining officers, I think that's the main way you can make sure that officers are going to do what they're supposed to do. Other than that, I don't know if training or ethics are really, really kind of the thing that's going to make officers make sure that they're not doing bad things.
Mm. Julia, what are your thoughts on this? When you have changes in a police force, how does that affect the media coverage? Do you think it softens it at all?
I think if, like, Baltimore's police department, for instance, they've made some really slow, they've started to make steps toward reforming their department. And even though that's happening and that's great, I mean, I still have to do my job and be critical of them because, you know, a year to the day after Freddie Gray died, a plainclothes officer shot a 14-year-old kid with that BB gun. So we still have to talk about that, too.
Right. Julia.
Yeah, reforms can make a – I'm sorry.
No,
reforms
it's okay.
Can make a lot of –
we're going to try to get a better line for Julia. Go ahead, Lawrence.
Reforms can make a lot of big changes, but it doesn't take many bad actors to engender the distrust in the community that is, you know, the real problem in a place like Baltimore. So even if you have a successful reform and you bring, you know, some sort of bad acting down by 75%, well – it only takes 5% to maintain that divide in the community.
I think this is a kind of a point to talk about the nature of police, right? I mean, I was talking to an investigator on a story I did on a police oversight, and the investigator simply said to me, like, most people don't understand what the purpose of police is. And we had spoken about this a little earlier, but I think, you know, it's the state, right? It's the state. It's, you know, in California, you know, you think about the state on a larger scale, like the nation or, you know, Sacramento. But really, the state is the criminal justice system in the most raw way. And that's the thing we have to deal with all the time. And I think oftentimes when we're having these discussions, there's not a recognition that, you know, what the nature of a, you know, security force is. Mm. And it has a purpose. And that's just what it is. Whether or not we have these reforms, which are all good, and I think that they're going to hopefully limit or reduce the amount of misconduct, but they're still a security force.
Lawrence, you were talking about that earlier, and in this piece you wrote, Who Can Save Sandtown? This is where Freddie Gray grew up, right?
Yeah.
And so you speak to a lot of people who have horrible services. For example, Ray Kelly of the No Boundaries Coalition said, we can't even get sanitation workers to come through a couple times a week and empty the trash cans. There's horrible public transportation. You interview people who have to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning to jump on 3 buses to get to work. And they say that if they feel like they're in danger of something happening, they won't call the police because they don't want the interaction. So can you also talk about that and what Jonah just mentioned, this sort of how do you report on the, you know, what are the police there for in this specific community?
Well, that's a thing in Sandtown. In Sandtown, you know, this Freddie Gray case makes this about police brutality. And then after the riots, the story in Sandtown is everybody talking to each other saying, are the police taking a knee? Are they not protecting us at all?
Hmm.
Are they not policing at all? And it's because, I mean, Sandtown's a great example. They have the highest incarceration rate, I think, in the state. And so most people in that neighborhood are familiar with the criminal justice system, right? They feel like the police don't treat them right. You know, they think the police are corrupt. They think the COs are corrupt, and that was borne out to some degree because there was a corruption scandal at the city jail. And then, you know, and you've got this verdict. They just have little hope of being treated fairly. So they're afraid of the streets. They're afraid of the dealers. But they're also afraid of the cops. The two people I wrote about, one comes home from work at about 3 or 4 in the morning, and one leaves for work about 4:45 in the morning. And they have to. And they feel like the police see them as junkies or just somebody out doing something wrong, and they're just trying to get to work. So there's this kind of crabs in a barrel cliche that everybody talks about in Baltimore, that if you're trying to get out and do something right, one crab or another is going to pull you back down into the bucket. Mm. So that is the lens. That is the perspective if you talk to the community here. And, you know, if they do things right, if they engage middle-class values, you know, they feel like they can't necessarily win if they don't. If they end up in the criminal justice system, they have little hope of being treated fairly. And I mean, the bigger context is just that there's the most work you're going to find is in the only industry there is drugs, and so the drug market is their anchor institution. That is the economic foundation to some degree of the community. So when you talk about, you know, are we going to change this one policy in the police department, and maybe you do see a few more cops walking the beat or whatever, that is a drop in the bucket. Mm-hmm. I think I mean, I don't live in that neighborhood, so I can't say that authoritatively, but I think it can be seen. I had lunch with a guy in Sandtown today, and I was like, that the verdict yesterday, was that just Baltimore being Baltimore, or is that the state's attorney just, you know, bollocksing things up? And he was like, both, man, both.
Wow. What are you working on right now, just quickly, Lawrence?
Actually, I'm doing some research for a book about structural inequality in the Baltimore region. Mm. It'll be an outgrowth of the lines between us.
Julia, what about you? What are you working on right now?
Right now, I am following up on McKinney, Texas.
And what's your follow-up?
Well, I'm just trying to talk to more people about it. I don't feel as though it got enough coverage, and I understand yesterday was a very, very busy news day, but I would just like to hear more from the people who were at the party, the people who were affected by this. Mm-hmm. So that's what I'm focusing on right now.
And again, just a reminder, because this didn't get a lot of attention, yesterday a Texas grand jury decided not to indict McKinney police officer Eric Casebolt for manhandling a black 15-year-old girl who was in a bikini at a pool party. You probably saw video. And just quickly, Jonah, what are you working on?
I'm trying to run down the connections between the OPD scandal and SFPD.
Jonah Lamb is a criminal justice reporter with the San Francisco Examiner. Julia Craven is a politics reporter with the Huffington Post, joining us from Washington. Lawrence Lanahan is a freelance print and radio journalist, joining us from Baltimore. And thank you all for joining us today.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. On the next Your Call, we'll kick off a week-long series on the homeless crisis in San Francisco. On June 29th, more than 70 Bay Area media outlets will come together for a day of homeless coverage. On Monday, we'll broadcast live from St. Anthony's in the Tenderloin, where demand for services is on the rise. We'll speak with providers, people who sleep on the streets, and people who have homes but can't afford food. Join the conversation on the next Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show. Malihe Razazan is senior producer. Matt Martin is executive producer. And Rosalie Atkinson is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Debbie Kennedy is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.